Will you repeat the last part of the combination?
So he suggested that my father buy the Post and the Sun from the estate, and he would combine the Sun and the Chronicle Telegraph. My father could have the Post and the Gazette Times. And my father said, well, you know, I'm not in a position financially to do this, because he had just completed his purchase of the Blade in Toledo, and he was not in a position to go any further at that point. So Hearst put up the money for both purchases, and my father had the option in the next 10 years to pay for the Post and Gazette Times. And that's what happened. He, by 1937, completed the purchase of the Post Gazette. But he became recognized as the publisher of the Post Gazette from 1927 on. Because he fully intended to make the acquisition. He didn't realize what the Depression was going to do to him and how difficult it was going to be, but he went through it anyway.
Did he live in Pittsburgh or in Toledo?
Hmm?
Did he live
in... Well, he lived in New York.
He was
very much a New Yorker. And, yes, he had gone to New York. He was brought up in Elmira, New York. I think we've been through that.
Yeah, yes.
And he went to New York in 1895, and he opened up his own representation business in 1900. And it was through that he gradually got into publishing. Well, anyway, when I got back, I worked here in Pittsburgh in 1937, the fall of 37. I worked in my father's New York office for about a year after I got out of college in 36. And then I went over to Toledo, and I was working in Toledo, starting as a trainee. And he decided that I ought to come down to Pittsburgh because we were building a new building for the Post-Gazette on 2nd and Grant. And he thought that I would learn a good deal by the whole business of the construction of a new building for a newspaper. So I was sent down, and Pittsburgh was a pretty gloomy town at that time, and I knew nobody here except a few of the people at the paper. And I remember that I rented an apartment at the Shenley Apartments, the Bigelow Apartments, on Bigelow and Center. And the room had a Murphy bed that came out of the closet. And I wasn't the happiest of times for me, especially going downtown in the gloom of the morning and the dirt.
Did Nat Cann own it at that time? Did Nat Cann own it at that time?
The Bigelow Apartments?
Yeah.
I really don't know. The reason I got there is that Joe Schumann, city editor of the Post Gazette, lived there, and he got me this room there, and with the Murphy bed, and I felt I was back in the army almost. Anyway, I worked for about 10 months here in connection with that building construction. We opened the building in the spring of 38. And then I went back up to Toledo, and I was in Toledo until I was drafted in the Army in 41. When we got back from the service in 46, what we had inherited was a six-day morning newspaper against Hearst with 7 days and Scripps Howard with 7 days. And this was very tough because they could increase their revenues on Sunday and leave their dailies alone And the only way I had to increase revenue was through the daily paper. And that made it very difficult. So when newsprint finally became available, because it had been, the supply of newsprint had been very tight during the war and after, and shortly after. And finally, in 49, we were notified by our major newsprint supplier that they could grant us some additional newsprint if we wanted to start a Sunday. And at the same time, the Chicago Tribune Comics, their syndicate, always were angry that they played second fiddle to the Hearst Comics in the Sun-Telegraph. The King Features, which was the Hearst syndicate, all of those comics had a prime position in the comic section of the Sun-Telegraph, and the Chicago Tribune comics were in a little tabloid, but not nearly as displayed as the Hearst comics. And they always ground their teeth over this, and so they came to us and offered us the Chicago Tribune comics, but we had to sign up by a certain date, because that was when their contract was expiring with Hearst. And if we didn't sign up for it, why, they would have to re-sign with the Hearst paper. So we had two elements there. We had available paper, newsprint, and available Sunday comics. So we decided we'd take a plunge into the Sunday field. Well, it was a very cold plunge, which the Scripps Howard people and the Hearst people really made life pretty tough on us. Anyway, we lasted less than a year and decided that we couldn't go on. So we closed it. That was an interesting experience, but somewhat of a bloodbath. Anyway, we entered, that was 49 when we did that. We entered the 50s. In the 1950s, was supposed to be a good year, and then we had a strike. We had a newspaper strike that lasted 47 days and ruined the year for us. The strike went from October 1 to November 17, and then shortly after November 17 came Thanksgiving Day and the huge snow.
Huge snowstorm.
We couldn't even get a paper out on Saturday after Thanksgiving. And so that was a very difficult year. And after that, after unsuccessfully trying the Sunday field, I started trying to negotiate with the Hearst people, thinking that perhaps if we could combine the Post-Gazette and the Sun-Telegraph and have a morning, evening, and Sunday, that we might be able to successfully compete against Scripps Howard and the press down here, which was moving very, very well at that time, growing in circulation and growing in advertising volume, at the expense of the Sun-Telegraph largely, not at the expense of the Post-Gazette, but mostly at the expense of the Sun-Telegraph.
Because of the advertising?
Yes, when the Pittsburgh Press would raise its advertising rates, they had such a dominant circulation in Allegheny County, and that's what the advertiser wanted in those days, because you didn't have the kind of road complexes you have today where people can come in from much further away. Allegheny County was the market for Coffins and Horns and all the stores of those days, Rosenbaum, Franken, Cedar, Box and Buell, and so forth.
Yes.
So the press was really making great headway, and I thought that the Hearst people might be interested in some kind of merger or combination of. Well, this was at the time when William Randolph Hearst was at death's door. I think he died in 1951. And their whole organization was in a state of paralysis because the succession had not been decided. There was a period there when nothing was happening because the old gentleman was not able to function. And it wasn't until about 1954, somewhere in there, 53 or 4, that they began to really think about the future a little bit more. And they were not interested in any combination with us. They decided to build a new building on Grant Street and put in a press there, two presses. And that was finished about, I would say, 1955. Well, they were going downhill so fast because of the pressure of the press and the pressure of the Post-Gazette. And I can remember going to see Irwin Wolf at the Kaufman's and getting Kaufman's to shift 200,000 lines of advertising from the Sun-Telegraph into the Post-Gazette. And those kinds of troubles were facing the Sun-Telegraph. And so in 1960, we were able to buy the Sun-Telegraph for practically nothing. It was an exchange of buildings because I thought that their new presses were needed for us to try to get out a successful Sunday paper. Well, it turned out that the Sun-Telegraph Sunday was slipping so rapidly that it was more of a burden to us than a blessing. And we found that we were losing quite a bit of money. And so we decided that we would approach the Scripps Howard people to see if they were interested in some kind of joint operating agreement. And the Scripps Howard people had believed in these joint operating agreements and had a number of them around the country. The joint operating agreement is where you merge your production facilities and distribution and sales efforts. You have one for the two papers, but separate editorial operations. And that was very popular in those days, and there were a large number of them around the country. Most of them have disappeared now. A great majority have disappeared because of the changing climate of newspaper operation. So we've made an agreement with Scripps Howard. Their interest was becoming the only Sunday in the field. We were in a negotiating posture because we had inherited the Sunday Sun-Telegraph. Even though it was weak, it was there. And it gave us a negotiating posture. And the result of that was that a joint operating agreement was made in 61, and we moved down here. And I guess I'm one of the few people who have worked at all three corners of the triangle. Anyway, we moved down here. And occupied the fourth floor in about November of 61. And this lasted until the strike and what came of the strike of 1992. We had some work stoppages in 71, I think, and 75, rather long strike in 75. And the press has had very bad. The press had very bad relationships with the Teamsters for a long time, and I have to say it was not entirely their fault. The Teamsters were a very difficult group when it was headed up by Theodore Kozar. And
who wound up in jail?
Hmm?
Who wound up in jail?
No, I don't think in jail, but was forced by the federal government as a result of underworld associations, forced to give up his role as president of the union and vice president of the international. And he's retired now, and I think is in Pittsburgh. He and I are just about the same age, I think. Anyway, we go through the 70s and the 80s, and the agency is working fairly well until you get toward the end of the 80s, and you begin to see a revenue that's very flat and an inexorable rise of costs. And this had been going on long enough that Scripps Howard, I'm sure, felt that something pretty revolutionary had to be done to change that situation. And in studying the situation, they came to a conclusion that was fairly obvious on the surface, that our distribution costs were just completely out of line, and that we had the most expensive distribution in the United States. So they set out in 1992, where their contracts expired in December of 91, and they were still theoretically negotiating. And they set out in 92 to do something radical to change the picture. And I think their strategy was absolutely right. Their tactics were absolutely wrong. They announced publicly that they were going to eliminate 450 jobs of the Teamsters. Well, there are only 620 members of that union. And how you get a union to vote approval of a contract that would eliminate much more than the majority of them is a $64 question that I can't answer. I don't know how you get a vote like that. Well, they negotiated for a long, long time, and they finally had come to the point where they could, that the union had agreed to 260 layoffs. And, you know, that was quite a large number. So anyway, I think they thought that they were getting close to an agreement, and then it seemed to all fall apart when they were down in Washington in, the strike started in May, and they were negotiating, I would say in September. Sometime in September, it all seemed to fall apart. And so, Scripps Howard announced on October 2nd that the press was for sale. On the 1st of October, they had called my son in Toledo, Bill Jr., and asked him where he'd be the next morning at 9, that they had an important announcement. And he said, well, I have to attend a breakfast, but he gave him a number where he could be reached at the breakfast. And then he called me and he said, where are you going to be at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning? I said, well, I guess at my desk. He said, well, you better be there because I'll... And he told me what had transpired. And we tried to guess at what it was. And we thought, well, maybe they have reached an agreement of some sort. The communication between the press and ourselves was very poor. And their general manager really kept us informed unless we pestered the life out of him to get information. So... The next morning, Bill called me a few minutes after 9, he said, you won't believe this, but the press is for sale. And, you know, we were really surprised. I never thought that they would sell the press, especially at the end of a strike when the price would be terribly depressed. If they had sold the press a year before that, in 91, they would have gotten at least double what they got. But that isn't the way the thing transpired. So anyway, they announced it was for sale. They said that First Boston Corporation was handling it. And they told us a man named Rutherford was the man to contact there. So we had a family meeting, I think on the 5th of October, and discussed it. Well, we were not in the best position at that time to try to make a purchase. We had just put in new presses in Toledo, which cost us a great deal of money, and we were in higher debt than we'd ever been in the company. And we're not people who enjoy debt. So we also had built a building and put in a press in Monterey, California, in a paper that we had acquired in 1967. And so we had a good deal of debt. So we interviewed a number of investment banking houses and finally hired one and started on the trail of how to go about this. We worked out a plan that was an effort not to have to borrow too much cash, but to try to make this deal with the least burden on our parent company, Blade Communications, Inc., which is a Toledo Blade, and three cable systems and four small television stations. And we didn't want to put too much of a burden on that entity in order to acquire the press. So we in our offer, we offered them the Monterey paper with its new building and its new press, and they would have no capital expenditure there. And but it was not making money because California at the moment, at this time, is having a very hard time. The economy in California is very bad, and Monterey is especially tough because Fort Ord is being abandoned by the federal government. That's a huge facility. So, by a number of different mechanisms, we made an offer. And it was accepted on the 28th of October. And they insisted on certain provisions. One, that we complete contracts with all the unions by November 30. So we had a little bit more than a month to accomplish what they couldn't accomplish in a year. We also had to get our financing completed by December 15th, and we had to clear this with the Justice Department, because any merger or purchase of this size, which would be a merger between the two newspapers, has to have antitrust approval. So, to make a long story a little bit longer, we completed our negotiations with the unions on November 30, and had a big party signing of the contracts on the 30th. We assigned a team to negotiate those contracts that had nobody on it that had previously been on the management side of the table. Because the press had become an enemy. The unions were very bitter about them, and especially about their effort to publish with what they call replacement workers and what the unions would call scabs. So there was a good deal of bitterness, and so our team was a completely different team. Our general manager from Toledo, who is now general manager here, Bob Higdon, was headed the team. He had a long experience in personnel and human resource work. Our business manager of the Post-Gazette, Ray Burnett, who had dealt with the guilds, because the guild was the only union we dealt with the guild for many years. And two labor lawyers from Lever Reed Smith, Leonard Scheinholz and Scott Zimmerman. And that was the team, and they did a fantastic job, working almost day and night. And I have to say that the spirit of the unions, once the Scripps Howard was out of the picture, the spirit of the unions was completely different. They trusted us. Our relationship with the Guild had been a constructive relationship over the years. They knew this. They knew Mr. Higdon because a number of their international representatives knew him because he had worked at some very large papers in the human resource area, Detroit News, Chicago Sun-Times, San Francisco Chronicle, and so forth. So they knew him. They had dealt with him before, and the two labor lawyers, of course, the local Teamster and other union leaders knew. So we had and their lawyer knew these lawyers. So I think we were fortunate in the team we picked. But also there was just a general mood that we had to get this thing over with. The unions certainly wanted to go back to work. And they were very constructive in all of this negotiation, with a possible exception maybe of one union. But almost all of them were very anxious to find solutions to the problem. And I have to say that, obviously, it's not easy for a union president. It's a political position, and they're answerable to the members of the union. So they don't have an easy time in negotiating reduction of force and things like that. Anyway, we were able on November 30 to sign them. We were able to get our financing in row. And then the antitrust thing came along, and that ground slowly. You have to file a great deal of material with the antitrust division in cases like this, and we were able to do that by November the 17th. And they have a month then to go over this material and make a decision. They can do one of three things. They can approve the deal, in which case you're ready to proceed. Or they can go to court to prevent the deal. Or they can ask you for more information. And then once you supply that information, they have 20 more days before they must make a decision. That's based on the Rodino law. So we filed on November 17th. December 17th, they asked for more information. And they provided us with a 26-page memorandum of what they wanted. We had checked with other companies that had similar experiences, so we knew pretty much what to expect. We knew that this was boilerplate, a lot of it. So our lawyers met with them and found out what they really wanted, and we were able to supply that in a week by December 24th. I have to hand it to the people at the Antitrust Division. They met all through that holiday period. They took a deposition from the general manager of the press on the morning of the 24th of December. They took from the head of Scripps Howard, they had him there on the 23rd of December. I spent 5 hours with them on the 28th of December. And they have two lawyers from the Antitrust Division and two economists sitting at the table.
End of tape 7, side 2, to be continued on tape 8.
All the records. And it's an interesting process, but very frustrating.